hell of a lot more accuracy. But unless you're given the key for the military code, you don't have access to it. That's the one that's a hell of a lot more accurate. But even that one could experience some improvement due to this WAAS system, to my knowledge. So you could say there's at least three different systems there. 1 megacycle, 10 megacycle, either of those with or without the WAAS augmentation. But it looks to me like Global Positioning Satellite and its brethren are going to be around for a long time, as I see it, Joe. The GLONASS system is the Soviet equivalent, which unfortunately these days is not running quite as well because it's not being maintained. And I vaguely remember reading an article in the last couple of months that Europe is now putting up another global positioning satellite system of their own. Part of the motivation for this is to have more control by their particular country. They've got pride, but we all are dreaming about the day when a really good GPS system on a passenger aircraft will allow you to land your aircraft on a foggy day at your airport without hitting any local buildings. They've run a number of experiments along those lines, and right now the reliability is not high enough to trust it, because every so often it'll give you a significant error because of the particular positioning of the satellites, and it is subject to a certain amount of mischief. In theory, an extremely well-equipped person could take a aircraft being controlled by GPS, create phony signals such that it intentionally crashes the aircraft. I didn't say it's easy, but it's possible. So a real landing of a passenger aircraft where the pilot does not see the runway. Right now, I think the FAA rules are something like, I think it's like 200 feet or 250 feet. If the pilot does not see the runway when he is down at that altitude, he's got to wave off that particular landing attempt. But we dream about the day when fancy landing systems will allow you to land on a foggy day, and therefore a lot more of the airport delays will be negated. W-H-U-L-Y-Y is the guy who asked this question. Fascinating question there, Joe. Back to you. Drag your feet in case anyone else is a little bit smarter on GPS and wants to correct on some of the things I said. W-H-U-L-Y-Y with the delay, K-H-U-L-I-W.
With a comment.
Go right ahead, Frank.
Okay, I'm certainly not smarter on GPS than any of you, but had a very interesting comment on GPS on one of the Discovery Science Channel's shows on time and measurements of time, etc. You've probably seen this one, Dick, where they commented about how early in GPS development either they knew about, or I think the way I understand it, maybe had an error of several kilometers that they didn't know about and couldn't explain at first, until somebody realized that what they were doing was measuring time very minutely, and the speed with which time runs, according to Einstein, differs the distance you walk gravity well. So time runs slightly faster at the satellite's altitude than it does at the Earth's surface, as time slows down, according to Einstein, as you go deeper into a gravity well, implying, of course, that in a black hole where gravity is infinite, time is infinitely slow. I wonder if you've heard that. We all think that, what Einstein discovered is, for the most part, doesn't impact our everyday life. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, fascinating subject there, Frank. And you've got part of what I believe correct and part of it a little bit incorrect. Time gets shifted by a strong local gravity field or by relativistic high velocities. In the case of a GPS satellite, the velocity component is, to my knowledge, drastically dominating over the gravity component. Yes, the Earth is a massive object, but compared to a sun or a black hole, it's not very heavy. And so the gravity component is a minor one, but the fact that the satellites are moving rapidly is a more major one. So the clock on board the satellite, if you were using good laboratory instrumentation and you were on that satellite, you would measure extremely high accuracy of that clock. However, when you're standing on the ground and you measure that clock, because the satellite is moving as fast as it is, you get a different answer due to, let's call it Einstein effects. And when you read enough of the articles about the GPS system, they have intentionally plugged in an error of the frequencies of the clock to take that Einstein effect back out, so that when you naively make a measurement with your properly operating GPS receiver on the ground of those satellites in space, that effect has been taken out, and now, in theory, you're capable of getting the right answer. So they've intentionally dithered the system to take out that effect, Frank. And it's kind of interesting. Okay, back to you, Joe. And who were you listening to that gave you all this information about GPS? The K2LYY, K2LIW.
K2LYY.
Stand by there, Joe. Go ahead, Bernie.
I'm definitely not more intelligent on GPS, although I am a heavy GPS user. There are a couple of good articles. If you Google what is WAAS and then GPS, Wikipedia's got a pretty nice write-up on it, and Garmin also has a short but informative write-up on it, so I'd recommend those for anybody.
Very fine, Bernie. So you GPS, what is WAAS, and my favorite way of doing Google these days is to put in a subject and then say plus Wikipedia. Of all the possible answers, I like the Wikipedia answers the best. And occasionally they got some error, but it's a beautiful peer-reviewed system where the error doesn't last very long on Wikipedia. Somebody comes along and says, well, it shouldn't be A, it's really B. And it gets corrected real fast. And you quite often get some very nice, straightforward answers with some good diagrams and other references and so on. So an amazing amount of information we can get from the internet these days. And 99% of it is darn good stuff. Look out for the 1% that is not. And particularly when it comes to subjects like radio frequency biohazard. The poor people in Bayville, Long Island have found one or two articles on the internet which would lead you to believe that RF radiation is giving them a lot of grief. And we're going to have to help our friends in Bayville slowly come to the truth, from my point of view, that radio is their friend, not their enemy. And to try to remove all radio devices from that beautiful town on the North Shore of Long Island is a foolish thing to try to do. That community is going to have to be brought into the 21st century, if you know what I mean. So we're going to have to help our friends, because lives are at stake, in my opinion. The law enforcement radios, the cell phone radios, the fire and police and emergency vehicle radios all need better performance. They need more antennas and more transmitters in that town, not less. And I hope the townspeople are not successful in their recent effort of trying to remove all antennas from the town. Their motivation is good. They believe they're protecting their children. But I think the bottom line is that's not the right way to do it. Back to you, Joe, to B2RYY, K2RYW.
Well, glad to bring another fascinating subject to the TechNet. I was talking to AJ4QP down in Florida via the internet, and he happened to mention this within the subject of geocaching, which I thought within itself is a fascinating subject. Would be basically people play like a hide-and-go-seek type of thing, but hiding things. They use GPS coordinates to go out with in teams or by yourself or whatever to go find stuff. And I said, you know, that you got to have, I guess, a really accurate GPS receiver nowadays to be able to find stuff within, you know, 10, 20 feet or 30 feet of what you're looking for, because otherwise you could really, you know, be out there looking quite hard for something and be like 150 feet away from it. And he said, yeah, the older receivers didn't employ this system he called WAAS, and that's why I'm asking you here to understand more. Because I have a GPS receiver, but it's about 1992, 93 vintage, so apparently it does not have this system in it.
Yeah, the modern-day GPS receivers have got a lot more horns and whistles. They got a lot more parallelism. I mean, a really good modern-day receiver, I think, can, in theory, look at the 8 or 9 satellites simultaneously in real time without time sharing. And therefore, its lockup time from a cold start is a hell of a lot faster. Its accuracy is better. It may have WAAS capability. They've improved a lot since 1992. I'm too cheap and I haven't bought one yet, but it's about time I do. And this sport that you discussed with AA4GP, I think it was, in Florida, is a little bit similar to a sport that's done in the United States called Orienteers, and it's a lot more similar to a sport they do in Asia, in Japan in particular, called Radio Sport, I think is what they call it, which is a combination of going in the woods, finding a transmitter, or finding a particular location. So it's a combination of fox hunting, direction finding, navigating, running. You got to be a marathoner, you know, a triathlete type person with a lot of radio smarts in order to win that radio sport event that's held periodically in Japan. So I wish there were more bunny hunts and fox hunts going on in Nassau and Suffolk County in Queens on Long Island, because there are times when we hear some signals in on our repeaters that really shouldn't be there. And with enough fox hunting, they can be discovered. And a smart person who is no longer anonymous when he's doing things like that would be foolish to keep on doing it. I think we've gone through the list. Oh, no. Paul's going to give us some information. Rich said he didn't have a question yet, but he's going to have one. You wait and see. We may hear from Alex and to...
just give you one comment in closing on fox hunts or bunny hunts.
Go right ahead, Joe. And what are we going to do to make more of them? You got a joke.
Okay, many, many years ago, I used to be involved with those once a month on one of the local repeaters in Selden. Probably just a few years after I got into amateur radio, about 77, 78, 80. I used to go out on them like once a month type of thing. It was very interesting to participate in. One of the best ones I ever went on, and it was one of the most difficult hunts I've ever been involved with, was when a bunch of guys got together on North Shore, and they were not too far away from St. Charles Hospital. And what they did, they used a passive repeater. They had like an 11-element beam aimed at their location on the ground. They were approximately a quarter mile away, maybe a little more than a quarter and a half mile away from the building. They were using a high gain directional antenna, like a little element beam, aimed back at the top of St. Charles. And the beam at the top of St. Charles was connected to an omni antenna. So from a distance, you didn't see the bunny originally from his location. What you saw is this massive signal, and you thought the guy's car was parked on top of St. Charles Hospital. Very good, and it took a lot of really careful DFing. To find the actual location of this hidden transmitter, but that was one of the best hunts I've ever been on. Have you ever heard of something like that being done?
Very crafty, and yes, I have. The Limog bunny hunt of about 15 years ago, WB2ZIT, Lloyd Mills, was involved in this one. And one of them, they aimed a high-gain beam antenna at a short distance at a water tower. So everybody was zeroing in on the water tower as the apparent location for the origin of the signal. And he himself was standing on the end of a dead-end street that was very difficult to get to. So you didn't see him, you heard the reflection off the water tower. And another time, he set up a bunny, which was a J-pole antenna on a bridge in, what town was that on the North Shore? Locust Valley, in the Locust Valley area. On the bridge was a J-pole antenna with a cable going down under the bridge where he was parked with his car. So everybody's zipping back and forth across this bridge, seeing a signal get strong, seeing a signal get weak, and they know there was no source of transmitter there. The actual transmitter was down under the bridge after a coax cable. We've also heard stories of people who put a bunny inside of a manhole and things like that. So when it comes to hiding a hidden transmitter, there are some pretty crafty ways of doing it, but aiming a high directional signal at a reflecting object and passive repeating is a pretty crafty thing to do. Let me drop.
Comment.
Okay, person comment. Get back to you in a minute. One of the most sophisticated kinds of antennas for UHF frequencies is called the periscope antenna system. People call it a fly swatter. Every so often you'll see a tower with a flat reflecting sheet or a nearly flat reflecting sheet that looks like a supersized fly swatter near the top of the tower, off to one side, aimed at a 45-degree angle to the ground. It's got an illuminating parabolic dish antenna on the ground with a radome over it, aimed straight up. The signal goes straight up the side of the tower, hits the fly swatter, gets reflected out into space at an angle parallel to the ground, and does the transmitting. That so-called beam waveguide system is extremely high in efficiency. So passive repeating and billboard antennas on top of mountains in rough terrain areas, very, very high performance when properly designed. So passive repeating of radio signals is a beautiful way of using in your favor the fact that RF always wants to do multipath. You may think that there's a beautiful line of sight path between you on this mountain and your buddy on another mountain a couple of miles away. You put on your binoculars and you see his antenna like gangbusters. Line of sight. You aim the antenna at him and he gets almost nothing. And you say, what the heck is going on? Why isn't the signal going there? Well, the signal is going there. But the reflecting objects that are off to one side, down below you, in that slight valley between the two mountains, the reflection of those, if they are in the wrong Fresnel zone, that's another whole chunk of mathematics itself, calculating the Fresnel zones, the reflection you get off the objects that are in what you think is the valley happen to come out equal in amplitude and 180 degrees out of phase at your buddy's antenna, and he gets very little signal. So there are times when optically you've got beautiful line of sight, radio you've got very poor conditions, because radio will bounce off every possible thing it can, and you can't stop it from doing that. At times it's good. At times it'll fight you. A person with the word comment, start off with your full call letters, your name, and then proceed. KQRIW, my name is Dick.
Another comment, N2HCM.
This is Tim, N2RDB.
You're right ahead, Tim, and HCN, you're recognized right after Tim. Go ahead, Tim.
You mentioned a wish that there were more people doing fox hunts and whatnot. There is a Yahoo group to which I would like to direct your attention. It's the LITHARC group, Long Island Transmitter Hunters Amateur Radio Club. They're always looking for new people to join the hunt. There are some people, not all of them do have DOF scan equipment, but they would certainly welcome more people joining. In fact, we've canceled hunts because there were only like two teams available to go out. So if there's people out there that want to do this, maybe the LITHARC group could be like a point of organization, you know, something to rally around, so to speak. You know, personally, I know a bunch of people. They were like, well, if I had a DOF scan or if I knew somebody that had one, I'd love to go out. You know, that's another thing. We might want to look into building some of those units. N2RDB, back to net.
Good information, Tim. So LITHARC, good bunny hunting crew. I know that Andy, the Bay2CDL, who is the technical maven of this group, one of them, him and Eric are the people who maintain the repeater. I know that they are trying to resurrect the fox hunts for this particular group. At one time, this particular group had a pretty active fox hunt team. Mr. HCN, sounds like Hotel Charlie November. Please give me your full call, your name, and then proceed with your comment. My name is Dick.
November to X-ray Juliet November.
X-ray Juliet November, start off with your name and your comment, sir.
And to XJN, my name is Wesley, and I'm from Queens, New York. I was just listening to that interesting information that you're giving to us, and I would like to express my great appreciation for you talking to us and giving us a lot of valuable leads. But at the same time, that the last that you were actually trying to cover.
Yes, you're right, that the reflected wave will be out of phase, and that person standing in the middle will have a little bit or no signal. But that's up to the antenna that you use. If you use directional antenna or change the polarization of your rubber duck antenna, everything will change. Am I right or wrong? Correct me, please. And to XJN.
XJN recognized, but Wesley, HCN, you're absolutely right. One of the things that I've mentioned often is that radio propagation, the multipath characteristics, and the chirality, the way polarizations get shifted, and circular becomes linear and vice versa, a little bit more complicated than first meets the eye. This repeater you and I are listening to is 99.9 and 44/100% pure vertical polarization at the transmitting site in Glen Oaks, Long Island. When that signal gets sifted through the trees, bounced off the water towers, bounced off the towers on my property, and gets into my bathroom, that signal is purely horizontal. When I'm in the bathroom shaving in the morning and I've got my handy-talkie sitting on the plastic counter, I have to lay the handy-talkie horizontal to get good reception. And I've got line-of-sight signal from my QTH to Glen Oaks, 20 miles away. I'm on 300 feet above sea level land. If I set my handy-talkie vertical, the signal almost fades out. So once the signal has been bounced in a complicated way through a real environment, lots of multipath, lots of polarization shifts, all kinds of funny things occur. We've all heard guys who will sign into this repeater where the signal from a handy-talkie is super weak. And the effect that we're talking about here is not only the polarization and multipath converting the signal to something else, but it's a frequency-sensitive phenomenon. Because the transmitter that you're using is 600 kc lower than the receiver, you can be moving that handy-talkie around till you get the best signal on reception. It is not necessarily the best signal on transmission. You may hear a nice strong signal, you transmit back, and they say, boy, your signal is terrible. Move the handy-talkie a little bit differently, and all of a sudden your transmit signal is a hell of a lot stronger, and the receive signal is slightly different. So lots of funny things happen. When it comes to the so-called Fresnel zone study of multipath, whenever you've got a real transmitting antenna and a real receiving antenna between two mountaintops, and you've got buildings and trees and whatever in the valley in between those two mountains, and you think you've got clearance, well, how many feet of clearance and how close those reflecting objects are to each antenna on each side makes a big difference. There's a whole bunch of these. Let me drop. These three-dimensional watermelon-shaped objects in space, which represent the odd and even Fresnel zones, where the signal reflecting from that object in that zone comes out in phase or out of phase to the receiving antenna. And now a really smart guy will use frequency diversity, positional diversity, polarization diversity, angle of arrival diversity, high-gain, low-gain antennas. As you switch the transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna in gain, elevation, polarization, position, altitude, use multiple antennas, use a multi-channel network that selects the strongest channel today. There's all kinds of ways you can improve the reliability. But every radio signal has a certain predictable reliability depending on what's called fade margin. A very rough rule of thumb is that if your signal is 10 dB stronger than required to get good reception, you're going to have a 90% probability of getting the signal through. Make the signal 20 dB stronger than required, and you'll have 99%. 30 dB stronger, 99.9% reliability, and so on. That's called Rayleigh fading. So we've got, if we're smart enough as engineers, we've got lots of tools at our hand that it can increase the reliability of a radio path. Antenna gain, polarization, clockwise, counterclockwise, linear polarization, high gain, low gain, high antennas, low antennas, different locations with the antennas, different frequencies. You put that all together with the right combination, you can make a hell of a lot more reliability out of a path if that's important to you. And if you're smart enough, it doesn't have to cost $1 zillion to do it. That's what I think Wesley is hinting at. And you're right on, Wesley. N2, Hotel Charlie November, I think is your call letters, KQRIW.
My call sign is November to X-ray Juliet November, and to X-JN. I would love if I can interrupt a little bit you, and if you, by talking about the antennas, will tell a few tips about the amplifiers. Some folks spend thousands of dollars thinking that they're going to be rich in the distant location at the same time, raising the antenna, or the gain of the antenna, will give you much better.
Yeah, sorry, I guess your call letters wrong. It's my accent, Wesley. Okay. There are times when a rather small change in the antenna that doesn't cost $1 zillion can make a 10-watt transmitter do the job, and a 100-watt transmitter might be a hell of a lot more expensive and not required and use extra power. So we as engineers have to try to get the best bang for the dollar. The nice thing about an antenna is that when you design an antenna with higher gain, more controlled pattern, better front-to-side ratio, front-to-back ratio, better side lobe levels, and so on, the nice thing about the antenna is when you do all that, you get all that benefit on both transmit and receive simultaneously. So because the materials that go into antennas many times are not expensive, to put your money in the antenna instead of into the transmitter and the low noise amplifier might be the better way to go. And if you can make the antenna more selective so that it aims all of its signal only at the desired target and doesn't waste signal in other undesired directions, you can be way ahead of the game. But the way we teach antenna science in the United States could be drastically improved. I've read an article out of one of the good electronic magazines over the last month, in which a particular electronic engineer working in industry in the Washington, D.C. area attends these meetings that are held once a year where industry and academia get together and compare notes. And he hears a common denominator where many of the people in the electronical engineering industry are requesting that the curriculum for our electrical engineering colleges should be improved. And the answer he was getting at that meeting is that, no, we've never done it that way. This is the curriculum we've always used. We intend to keep doing it this way. Well, the way we teach RF and wireless is such that the average electronic engineer with a high grade point average coming out of a good school with a bachelor degree and sometimes a master's degree barely understands what an antenna is. Certainly couldn't go out in industry and start designing them. And yet, the guy might be specializing, let me drop. He might be specializing in RF engineering, communication engineering, wireless engineering. That's his specialty. That's his chosen field. And a gold-plated transmitter and a gold-plated receiver with the best transmission line in the world is going to be relatively useless if it's not connected to a good antenna. The antenna is the more common denominator of the RF system. And in the senior year of most of our good electrical engineering colleges, they barely mention the word antenna. And they certainly don't give that student enough hands-on information as to how to go out and design one, use one, understand if it's working well, or whatever. We de-emphasize that subject. That's crazy. As such, a hell of a lot of American companies are outsourcing their antenna requirements because they don't have the smarts internally to design, build, construct, manufacture, maintain, create quality control or whatever. They don't have control of that. And they're leaving a lot of money on the table, in my opinion. And if you're running an electrical engineering company and you want to go out and hire an antenna engineer, you've got a serious problem. There are so few of them. And when you find one, he got that knowledge because he was a ham radio operator. He was interested in the subject most of the time. That's where he comes from. It took a 20-year apprenticeship for him to get that knowledge. Once he gets that 20-year apprenticeship knowledge, by then he is not a young man anymore. He has set down roots. He is planted at some particular company. If they're treating him well, he's got brand loyalty, you're not going to move him. He's got a house that's well established in a particular town, he's working for a particular company, and no matter how drastic your need is, and you want to double his salary, and you think you're going to move him to another state, if the guy's got any intelligence, he's not going to move. Not unless he's willing to really change his lifestyle. So it's a troublesome problem. We don't teach them, even though we need them, and the ones we've got are too few, and you can't move them. Now, I claim to be an antenna engineer. As such, I'm treated very well. I don't worry anywhere near as much as many other people in my field have to worry about job security. I have a rare black art from some people's point of view. And as a consulting engineer, I have to turn down work because I get more than I can handle because there are so few people with that skill. That's a bunch of opinions from my point of view. I think this is some of what you're saying, Wesley. I put a few more words in your mouth, and I know that. N2XJN for a rebuttal, if you'd like. K2RIW. I was passing it back to you, Wesley. You can make some more comments if you want to. I may have put Wesley to sleep. Sorry about that. Let's go over to Paul. Let's make sure we get to him before the wee hours. Paul, when those two spacecraft crashed into the moon to find out if there's any water in that northern North Pole area in the dark craters, the word I heard a couple of days ago was that something like 18 gallons of water was splashed up 10,000 feet in the process. If you happen to have some more spots on this one, Paul, tell us about it. WS2N, our space expert, K2RIW. You got it, Paul.
Very good, Dick. This is WS2N. Yeah, well, I've read 20 gallons, close enough. That was in the plume. You know, when the LaCrosse satellite took the pictures of the Centaur rocket crashing into the South Pole, they did the experiment. They expected a 6-mile-high plume. So anybody that watched it live was disappointed. They really didn't see anything. It wasn't until they got the close-up, you know, pictures of the that they, you know, they finally released on the internet that people did see something. And the plume was 1 mile high. But out of that 1 mile high picture that you see, you've got 20 gallons worth of water in the form of a spray coming off from the south pole of the moon. So that's pretty good. They're all very happy about this. It doesn't tell them how much water is down there, but, you know, I mean, they did pick one particular spot. Would they get a bigger splash if they went somewhere else, or, you know, was it pretty much the whole south part of the moon in those dark craters? Water frozen there billions of years. So they're very happy about this. It's good results. Let me drop it. You know, they didn't know what they were going to get when they launched this thing back in June for the Atlas rocket. Actually, the main spacecraft that was developed for that launch was the LRO, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. That took pictures, too. That was above the area where this spacecraft crashed into the moon. But that was the main spacecraft for that flight. But they had room on it, like a lot of times they'll have a launch and they need to run another, you know, instead of just putting lead weight in there, you know, they'll make another spacecraft and put it in. That's what they did here. A couple of years, I think like 3 years in development, the Lunar Crater Observation Sensing Satellite, LaCrosse as they call it, was put together and launched with LRO. Attached to the LaCrosse was the Centaur rocket, and that went all the way to the moon with the LaCrosse. LRO went into a orbit right away when it got to the moon. The Centaur LaCrosse combination went into a high orbit, instead of just orbiting the moon, it actually orbited the Earth and then came back to the moon. We dropped it. And then crashed into the moon on time. They predicted that day was in October. And they crashed at some 6,000 miles per hour when they did it. And then following the crash of the Centaur booster rocket, the LaCrosse spacecraft itself crashed into the same location 4 minutes later. And they have pictures of that from the LRO. But a lot of astronomers were a little disappointed. They were told if you had this 12-inch diameter lens at home, you'd be able to see this. But nobody saw anything from their amateur location, from what I read. So that's pretty much it regarding that flight. I also had a little further information on the Dawn spacecraft. Maybe we can get to that after this. Back to you, Dick. WS2F.
I'm hearing an extremely weak signal, but I'm not able to get the call letters from it. You're going to have to move to a different location. One of the articles I went to, one of the NASA sites, showed the actual spectral signature of the reflection from the plume. They matched it to water vapor, and it looks like an extremely close match, with a couple of extra glitches in there, like there's a little bit of some other material. The moon itself, although it looks like a bright object when you've got a full moon, compared to the darkness of sky, the moon really is a fairly dark object. So when you're seeing the nearly transparent plume against the dark background of the moon, to a guy with an 8-inch or a 12-inch telescope on Earth looking at this event, there's not much to see, and it's not very exciting. It takes better instrumentation with the infrared sensing spectrometer to really find out what's in that plume. I'm amazed, as you can tell, because with the hard vacuum of the moon and no real local atmosphere, I expected any water vapor would, if it was ice, it would sublime, jump directly from the solid state to the liquid state and evaporate off the moon and go out into space. There's very little holding it there. I'm guessing this water is locked up in some kind of compound below the surface of the moon. The water just sit there as innocent ice cubes on the surface, even though it's a dark corner of a crater on the south pole. I thought it was north pole, the south pole of the moon. There are places where the sun never shines on some of those craters that are very close to the south pole. So the sunlight not hitting the soil helps the survival time. But some of the water that's on that moon would have to be there for, let me pick a number, 1,000 years. It's believed that an awful lot of the water on Earth came from the comets that crashed into the Earth, because they contain water. And so those comets are crashing into the moon, and that's one of the methods by which water is being deposited to the moon. But I think it's evaporating off pretty fast. The solar wind, because the moon has so little gravity, it doesn't have a bow shock wave, a gravity protection shield like the Earth has. Therefore, the solar wind is continuously peeling off any vaporous material that's around the lunar surface. And how the water is surviving is a bit of a surprise to me. So tell me what you think the water is, in what form, Paul, and then go on to your next space subject. WS2N, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Well, just like a month or so ago, they figured out that there's water spread out throughout the whole surface of the moon, even in the equatorial regions. It's mixed with minerals, and, no question about it. Now, I'm sure down in the craters, it's probably covered. You might have big deposits of water that crashed into the moon years ago, and here they are. Just covered probably maybe by dirt, so you might have like little lakes in there in the bottom of these craters. I don't know. I guess that I'll have to look into that further. I mean, they're just happy to see this. Someday they plan on putting a manned base at the south pole of the moon, with the theory that you're going to get the minerals down there, you're going to get the, you might be able to excavate and actually live on the surface of the moon, so you don't have to worry too much about the cosmic rays. You'll be able to be on a south pole. There's plenty of areas down there that always get light, so that's important too. You know, you got the dark craters with the water, but you also have the areas where you can set up solar panels and get plenty of energy from the sun, and you'll be able to take the water, separate the water. You'll be able to breathe the oxygen. You'll be able to use some of the hydrogen for fuel, not only to power spacecraft, but I think you could use the hydrogen to power equipment right there on the moon. You got the oxygen and your hydrogen to do that. The minerals, whatever they might be, I'm sure they'll be able to mine that and utilize that somehow. But the idea is not to bring as much stuff to the moon. I know we talked about it in the past. It comes out to $10,000 per pound of everything when you bring everything with you. So that's the story on that. I wanted to mention the Dawn spacecraft. Let me drop it. And this is WS2N. Dawn spacecraft was launched a couple of years ago, back in 2007, and its mission is to go to the asteroid belt. Well, it entered the asteroid belt, and then it left for a while, and now it's back for good. It's going to stay there and eventually visit the asteroid Vista, and also Cirrus. Biggest asteroid there. Now they call it a protoplanet. So that's from that debacle with Pluto and all. So you've got the two biggest asteroids this thing plans on visiting. Dawn spacecraft flew out there with an ion engine using xenon gas. After it was launched, this ion engine is what propels it. The thrust of it is equal to the amount of a piece of paper that you would put in your hand. The only difference is you could leave this thing on for not only hours and days, you could leave it on for years, and it could just keep accelerating. The xenon gas comes out of the back of the engine at 70,000 miles per hour. So theoretically, if you left it on long enough, you could get the spacecraft up to that speed there. Now, the nice thing about this engine, let me drop it, is you could run it not only for, like I said, days, weeks, but for years. So eventually in 2012, thereabouts, it's going to go into orbit around Vesta. And it'll be around Vesta for 6 months or so. It's got three detectors on board, neutron spectrometer, it's got a regular camera, and infrared. They'll be able to evaluate what the asteroid is made of. They've got some, hypothesis on what it is, and that will confirm it. But it's a planetary type of spacecraft, because it will leave orbit some 6 months later, and then around the year 2015, go into the orbit around the other asteroid and take pictures of that, do the same type of thing. So, it's just that the reason I'm bringing it up is it finally moved to its proper orbit in the asteroid belt. So it's getting there slowly but surely. Back to you, Dick, WS2N.
Is the Dawn spacecraft sending back pictures? Does it have some hidden cameras? And since Cirrus is a protoplanet, I would suggest it's a round object. I wonder if you happen to know how big that object is. And what is Dawn going to do? This is not one of those missions where it's actually going to land on a asteroid. Is that true, Paul? Back to you, EQLAW.
I don't have any plans on landing it anywhere. I don't know what they plan on doing after the second asteroid. The diameter of that, I think it's, is it 800 miles, I think? I could find that in a couple of seconds with either my book or, of course, the internet. I think it's an 800 mile diameter. But yeah, it's round. It's the only one that you could see from Earth with your eye. Well, not my eyes, but somebody with good eyes in a dark area could see that asteroid or protoplanet. The other ones you really can't see, you need telescopes. But I think that was the first one discovered. So, Dawn, no plan on landing it. Maybe they'll have it leave orbit, go somewhere else, you know, as an extended mission that they tend to do that. It's a big thing. It's got 60 feet long, all kinds of solar panels. It does need a lot of electricity to operate the ion and drive engine. And, of course, the radio equipment and the detectors on board. It's not like there was one that landed on Eros, another asteroid years ago, called the Near spacecraft. And nothing was ever planned on really landing on the asteroid. Went into orbit around it and dropped. This is WS2N, TechNet. Plan was to go into orbit around this potato-shaped looking asteroid. Then they got the bright idea, hey, you know, what are we going to do? Let's try to soft land it on the asteroid. And they did. I mean, you know, they went through the whole thing. Figured out the orbit, gravity, managed to bring the near spacecraft, closer and closer, and without any, it didn't have landing gear or nothing. It just a big box with the solar arrays. It just lightly landed it, and it survived and back signals after that. Eventually, they shut it down. Mission over. Back to you, Dick.
I should know, but I don't. What is Dawn doing? Gathering local gases from the asteroid that it goes near? And second of all, nice thing about an ion engine is you get a huge, what they call a specific impulse. That's the efficiency of a rocket engine. You get a lot of thrust with very little fuel. But still, with it using, I think you said, xenon fuel, it's eventually going to run out of that fuel. The one thing wrong, that's not perfect, about an ion engine is you're still giving up mass much, much more slowly, but mass is leaving your vehicle. Eventually, you've got no more mass to throw out the back end of that ionic engine. So the fuel on board is good for thrust for what length of time. And what kind of data is Dawn gathering? I'm sure it's got all kinds of spectrometers on board looking at with high-resolution photography and infrared and ultraviolet and whatever, is actually looking at the asteroid that goes near. Is it gathering any other material, like the cloud of material coming off these asteroids? Back to you, Paul.
No, it's not like the Stardust spacecraft. That's the one that went around that passed the comet. Spelled WILD, but not pronounced that way. That had a big catcher's mitt on it, aerogel and all, and then actually came back to Earth. That was a sample. The Genesis spacecraft did the same thing. That didn't work out too good. That was getting particles from the sun. The parachute didn't open and crashed into the Earth, Utah, and They actually managed to get quite a bit of signs out of that one. But no, this one is just a spacecraft with a picture-taking capability, spectrometer on board, but also this neutron gamma gadget. You know, what is it? It looks at the sun bounces its rays off this thing, and there's different minerals that could be detected with this gamma ray detector. They've used that on a lot of different spacecraft, and by detecting the neutrons that come off the amount, or however they do it, they're able to tell what the asteroid is made out of. So they want to know what it's made out of. They believe, like Ceres, has a lot of water on board that protoplanet. They'll confirm that if they get a high hydrogen signature, similar to what they did on the south part of the moon when they first investigated that with the Clementine spacecraft. Back to you.
There's an extremely weak signal trying to get in, but I can't copy the call letters. Very fine, Paul. Sounds like some base information is going to come out of here. When do you believe Dawn will complete its mission, and what will the final outcome be? A better analysis of these particular asteroids as to what they're made of and how much water they contain? Is that approximately what the goal is here, as well as proving out the worth of a ion engine? And how long do you think that ion engine is going to have fuel before it uses up the mass that is pulling out the back end? Back to you, Paul.
Okay, yeah, science-wise, for instance, Sirius is a planet that never... let's say if Jupiter wasn't there, all the orbital material that was laying around at the beginning of the Earth might have collected more in that area. And voila, you might have had a planet there instead of a big asteroid. So that's, you know, that's like going to the beginning of the solar system. It's a remnant of what Mars or Earth could have been like years ago, before, you know, before we got to the size that we are. So they'd like to investigate that, number one. Number two, the fuel on board, the xenon gas. It was with ion engines, you could really use any kind of gas. Strip off the electrons, protons, shoot them out of the back of the spacecraft. But they like to use xenon because it's heavy on a periodic table. I don't know where it is, but it's up there. And it's roughly 4 tons in the mass of regular air, you know, we breathe. So it's heavy stuff. So you get this, you know, stuff accelerating at 50,000 miles an hour. And that's going to be good. And in the vacuum of space, it works real well. It's going to be flown on another spacecraft. It's not the first one to do this. But it's a little bit bigger than the previous one. I think the Mir spacecraft, the one I talked about before, it landed on Erebus, had the same capability, same type of rocket. This thing here is like an upgraded one of those. It can run for years. It just, you know, you don't even have to shut it off. When will it run out? I don't know. I know it's good till 2015, because that's when it goes to orbit around the second asteroid. After that, I don't know. I guess I'll make a determination at that time. So this stuff lasts a long time. I don't know. I don't know what the weight of it is. I guess I should look up how much weight, you know, how much all this weight, the xenon was before it left Earth. That would be interesting to find out.
Are you saying that ionic engine can run nearly continuously, 24/7, until the year 2015? Is that what you're saying, Paul?
Oh, yeah. We've been on for years. That's the plan. Well, they shut it off. I guess
intimately, you want to make sure you, I guess if you're going in the right direction, don't turn it on, you know. But, chemical engines are real good, but you turn that on and it goes right out the exhaust. You don't get much time out of that. Here you don't get much thrust. Yeah, I mean, you couldn't take off from Earth with this thing. But being, floating around in space with no resistance, it comes on. It's kind of like a blue light that comes out of the back. And, I've read and heard as this thing was being developed that you can, and they do, leave it on for months and maybe a year at a time.
Fantastic. Have you also seen that website talking about the another kind of an XPRIZE for a space elevator experiment, where you get a good fraction of a megabunk if you can build a space elevator which will climb a 1 kilometer rope, ribbon cable, at the rate of 2 meters per second, with no energy sources, no stored energy sources on board. All of the energy is coming from the ground in the form of a laser beam or an RF beam. And I think there was a recent winner of 0.9 megabucks of the 2 megabucks available because they went more than 1 meter per second for the whole kilometer. Have you heard about that particular experiment, Paul, K2RIW?
Yeah, out in Edwards Air Force Base, I think it was, 2 weekends ago. They ran a competition. They said everybody was running lasers, so I did hear there was a winner. They apparently had this cable attached to a helicopter, because a couple of years ago when they had the same deal, they used a big crane, with a big chip on it. I think it was 300-400 feet high, and they tried to get these little elevators to get all the way to the top. Nobody won that year, so a couple of years went by, and here we are again, and this time it's supposed to be attached to a helicopter. And a kilometer high, I guess a tenth of a mile. So, I looked on the internet, something came up. I was in the middle of searching for the results of this, and I got as far as reading that somebody won, but I really don't have any other details. But I believe it was two weekends ago they had this competition thing. It sounds good, $1 million. How many hours and how many dollars do you got to pour into your experiment to get this thing done? I don't know. Probably a lot of colleges, I guess. I don't know who's involved in trying to win this. Back to you, Dave.
Question.
Go ahead with the question. Start up with your call letters and your name.
November. Sorry, Julius. November. Wesley.
This is...
I remember the time, I believe it was 1998, I was one of the lecturers in International Optical Conference in Denver, Colorado. And there was a similar subject that we were trying to discuss. And one thing that I remember from that, which actually kind of I do not understand in here, if we're talking about ionic-based engine and we're talking about environment that has no friction, the amount of energy that is delivered for the period of 1 year would cause the increase of the speed. In other words, is when you put something in 5,000 miles an hour, then you switch off the engine, it's going to run with the same speed. That's the theory. Now, if you put that engine in motion constantly, then I do not understand the point of keeping it 75,000 miles. It's basic. For example, wrong. November 2, X-ray, Julius, November.
Okay, I've been listening to you on the input. for reasons I don't understand, the machine drops out a little bit